we hear of different book, the first one being from the right law. Maybe first as a way of welcome, one must indicate that, you know, yesterday we had a very long day. We were very bad, and this is a personal critique or inward critique. We were very bad with regards to time management. Or I was bad. I managed time very badly yesterday. And as a result, I stand accused and I accept any critique that comes my way in terms of time management. So I would not want that to happen today, because members have cautioned me that it is Friday today. Other members that are connecting flights to me, because we are not all from Gauteng. If you are from Johannesburg, you can even get a flight at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock to Togo. But if you are flying to Mpumalanga, if you are flying to Kimberley, if you are flying to Limpopo, you must connect, and there are strict and limited flights as well. So can we, I'm just appealing to the presenters that please be cautious. Be cautious with your input. I'm not limiting you, I'm not denying you an opportunity to speak. I'm not denying you the right to know or the right to speak. But please just bear with us on how we proceed. So let me then take the opportunity to allow the right to know led by Mr. Murray Hunter, Mr. Nkwame, Ms. Sherin, Ms. Gabriela. You are all welcome if you are all here. I don't know which one is which one, but as you make your presentation, you will identify or attach the name to the face so that you know who's who. Thank you very much. We are all yours.
I'm worried about the quorum of the meeting that is undermined by the wearing of caps.
Oh, Mabazo. Okay. No, members are correct. You see, committee meetings are an extension of the house. It is like the house sitting on the floor. So we would appreciate if that can also be respected. And you know in the house meeting that members are allowed to participate and members of the public are allowed to listen and not participate as well. So clapping of hands, cheering, supporting in whatever way, gestures and all that. Into another, we try, all those that, contract those that, until I think. And then we'll be able to proceed. Thank you very much, right, you know, we are all here.
Thank you very much, Chair of the House, committee members, and civil society members. My name is Nkwame Sekile. I'm here with my colleagues, Marie Hunter and Sherin Mokadam, coupled with Bill Kapitan Jenny here behind us. We have decided to do our submission in three parts. I will start with the first part, followed by Sherin, and then Mari will do the conclusion remarks. Firstly, I must say, Mr. Chair, that the right to know recognizes the need to replace the apartheid era secret law and the 1996 document called NIS. But I must also say that we are concerned with the statement that those opposing the bill are local proxies of foreign powers. We also want to argue that the bill, as it is usually mentioned, that it's more than just titling and birth certificates. I mean, if the bill required an e budget of millions in advertisement, then it must be more than just titling and birth certificates. What if we introduce the right now? The right to know is a national campaign, the coalition of organizations, individuals that are opposed to the protection of state information in its current form. Our campaign is in Western Cape, Gauteng, KwaZulu-Natal, and in Eastern Cape. We have four provincial working groups and a national working group, consisting of representatives from various civil society organizations, community groups, and social movements from across the country. The process of capacity taking place at the same time. We believe, this is our statement in the direction of that we believe that a responsive and accountable democracy should be able to meet the basic needs of our people, is built on transparency and the free flow of information. Our founding statement, let the truth be known, stop the secrecy deal, demanded that the deal be drastically rewritten to bring it in line with the values of our constitution and have them democratic. Our vision. We seek a country and a world where we all have the right to know, that is to be free to access and share information. This right is fundamental to any democracy. That is open, accountable, participatory, and responsive, able to deliver the social, economic, and environmental justice we all need. On this foundation, a society and an international community can be built in which all we live free from want, where we all enjoy equality and dignity. When we come to the vision, Our founding statement identifies seven key points that are included in the right to know 7-point presentation. Before this legislation can be consistent with the values of our constitution and have them democracy, we acknowledge the significant changes made in the deal, which is a result of people's struggle and the good sense on the part of political parties from political sectors, from across political spectrum, inside and outside parliament, as well as on the part of the architects of the deal. However, there is still some distance to go. This will be apparent from our analysis below of the shortcomings of the deal and when measured against the 7-point preconditions. But before we get into the details, here are some of the key issues flagged at the outset. The bill is trying to force people, that's our argument, that the bill is trying to force people to police themselves, namely the keeping of state secrets. Ordinary people should not be criminalized for possessing and disclosing classified information. To do so, we add South Africa towards a society of secrets, where free information exchanges and debates are inhibited by a culture of fear. One of the key demands of civil society is that of a public interest defense, and that remains absent from the deal. The state security concern remains the beneficiary of unjustifiably heightened protection, not only for its work but its organizational being. This stresses the deal of beyond what is acceptable in a constitutional democracy such as ours. The Minister of State Security Agency's role as guardian of our State Department available information remains a process. the suggested classified review panel is not independent enough and not accessible to ordinary people. That drafting, in a number of instances, has left the bill in its current form wide open to abuse. And with that, I end my opening remarks. I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for the hand over to Sherry Mukadam, that will take the second phase of our conversation.
So Sherry is the one who's going to lead us now to the key. I thought that we had a principal agreement that we're going to manage in such a way that we get to the bone of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nkwame. Mr. Chairperson, honourable members, ladies and gentlemen. Our 7-point freedom case also outlines the right to know key demands. These include, the law should apply only to core state bodies in the security sector, such as police, defense, and intelligence agencies. Even then, the board's powers must be limited to strictly defined national security matters, and no more. Officials must give reasons for making information secret. Thirdly, exclude commercial information from this law. Do not exempt the security agencies from public scrutiny. Do not apply penalties for unauthorized disclosure to society at large, only those responsible for keeping secret. Do not criminalize whistleblowers and journalists. The bill must protect those who release classified information if that information is in the public interest. Finally, an independent body appointed by Parliament and not the Minister of State Security should be able to review decisions about what may be made secret. The right to know welcomes the narrowing of the application of the board's classification provisions to core security bodies. However, we remain concerned at the apparent ease with which the Minister may extend the board's application to further state bodies, as no parliamentary process and no opportunity for public comment are provided. The law also empowers the Minister in Clause 54, Subclause 1, to make regulations regarding the protection of valuable information. The Minister's default responsibility is secrecy, and if he is mandated for safeguarding valuable information which should not be destroyed, these records are more likely to become secret. Even the state bodies entrusted with the power to classify should exercise that power only to the extent that it is, and they can show it to be truly necessary to protect the security of the nation. The bill must guard against undue and over-classification and facilitate declassification to the greatest extent possible. The protection afforded to the exposure of a state security matter creates a circular reference when read with the definition of a state security matter. According to the law, national security includes the protection of the people of the Republic and the territorial integrity of the Republic. Again, Subclause 4, exposure of a state security matter with the intention of undermining the constitutional order of the Republic. A state security matter is defined as anything which includes a matter which has been classified in terms of national law and which is dealt with by the agency, or which relates to the functions of the agency or to the relationship existing between any person and the agency. If you read these definitions together, it would say, national security includes the protection of the Republic and the territorial integrity of the Republic against the exposure of any matter which is dealt with by the agency or which relates to the functions of the agency or the relationship existing between any person and the agency. The safeguard that there must be the intention of undermining the constitutional order of the Republic is no safeguard at all. At the time of classification, any intention of a person wishing to expose a state security matter would be purely hypothetical. Put differently, on the current definition, the state security agency might consider itself justified to classify information about itself and its activities simply to prevent for an unintended veil of secrecy over all aspects of the State Security Agency's activities, even those that should properly be in the public domain to ensure accountability. The language in Clause 6J appears to defeat the purpose of instructing the decision-maker to perform a balancing act. Rather, it appears to create a national security override, which suggests that national security is more important than any other consideration, which is inconsistent with our constitutional values. Clauses 11 to 14 provide the method for classifying state information, classification levels, authority to classify, and the conditions for classification and declassification. However, there is no provision that when information is classified, the responsible official must give reasons for the classification decision. The right to know believes that undue and over-classification will be prevented if officials are required to provide the exact reason for the classification at the time of the decision. It is also served to protect the official concerned if there are any subsequent challenges to the appropriateness of the classification decision. The bill provides for a distinction between confidential, secret, and top secret information as follows. State information may be classified as confidential if the information is sensitive information, the disclosure of which is likely or could reasonably be expected to cause demonstrable harm to national security of the Republic. State information may be classified as secret if the information is sensitive information, the disclosure of which is likely or could reasonably be expected to cause serious demonstrable harm to the national security of the Republic. State information may be classified as top secret if the information is sensitive information, the disclosure of which is likely or could reasonably be expected to cause serious demonstrably cause serious or irreparable harm to the national security of the Republic. From these definitions, there is no practical difference between the cause serious demonstrable harm required to classify information as secret and the demonstrably cause serious or irreparable harm required to classify information as top secret. Our concern is that this current wording will allow information to be classified as top secret too easily. In Clause 13, subclauses 1 to 4 attempt to ensure that classification decisions are taken at a sufficient level of seniority to reduce misclassification. However, it is problematic that the level of seniority is not defined. Of even greater concern is subclauses 6 to 9, which provide that police, defense, and intelligence officials may classify regardless of their level of seniority, and that the classification decisions remain in force until and unless overruled by their department head. Problem is that no time frame is provided by when the head of an organ of state must confirm the classification decision. In Clause 8, subclause 5C, it is assumed that must publish the annual report on regular review means that the report must be made public. However, there are no minimum standards provided of what must be contained in the public report. By way of example, at present, the Retail Judge's annual report on monitoring and interception, as well as the Auditor General's annual report on the intelligence services, reveal information so minimal that it defeats whatever public confidence might have been instilled by making it public in the first place. Clause 55, subclause 2, says that all information previously classified, no matter if it occurred under the unconstitutional apartheid era legislation, remains classified. The same penalties apply for the possession of this previously classified information. We propose that at the very least, this clause should exclude the possession of previously classified information so that we can apply for its declassification. If not, journalists, academics, and researchers will become instant criminals for possessing information
the honourable members, it's worth noting, for instance, just with the document, the minimum information security standards, which have been followed since 1996, organs of state which are not key security bodies have already been classifying information, which will be de facto classified in terms of this bill once passed. And just for an example of where our concerns with that stem, last year in 2011, in a written answer to parliamentary questions, the Department of Higher Education indicated that in its first financial year, that's 2009-2010, it had classified 389 documents as secret in terms of the MIS. So that was 148 which were top secret, 212 which were classified as secret, and the remainder were simply confidential. Now, we have no way of knowing what is in those 389 documents. It's very difficult to see how the Department of Higher Education is classifying information in terms of national security. But what we do know is as soon as this bill passes in terms of the course of the first year, that information will be protected at extraordinarily high penalties for disclosure. And we believe that that should be a significant concern to the committee members, and we urge you to apply your mind on that particular concern.
GLASMO welcomes the removal of provisions allowing for the classification of commercial and private information from the bill. However, the bill provides the following definition. National security includes the protection of the people of the Republic and the territorial integrity of the Republic against, subclause B, the following acts. Point 5, the exposure of economic, scientific, or technological secrets vital to the Republic. We are concerned that this may reopen the door to the classification of commercial information which was previously excluded from the bill. The problem could have been ameliorated by the safeguard in clause 14, subclause 2H, which reads, against the undue classification of scientific and research information. However, there is no safeguard against the undue classification of economic information. The safeguard should include economic information. Thank you. I'll now pass on to my colleague Murray, who will continue to take you through the presentation.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, honourable members. Moving on to the fourth concern that we've identified, and which we believe does require further attention from this committee. Our concern number four is do not exempt the intelligence agencies or the state security agencies from public scrutiny. And we believe that even if the work of intelligence agencies may need to be protected from exposure where national security is at stake, this should be limited as far as possible, and there is still a good degree of transparency that is required from these organizations. The agencies themselves should remain transparent and accountable, just like any other democratic institution of our government. I'm going to point to concern 4.1 in our submission, the prohibition of disclosure of a state security matter. Now, we've already raised in concern 2.1 how the definitions of national security and the interplay between that and the exposure of a state security matter creates a circular reference which has the effect of potentially bringing all work of the SSA and its functions and its activities under the purview of national security. This is further complicated by clause 49, which says, digested, any person who has in her possession or under her control or information which she should reasonably know is a state security matter, who intentionally discloses such information, intentionally publishes such information, retains it or neglects or fails to take proper care of such information, is guilty of an offense and liable to conviction, to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 10 years, and if it is proved that the publication or disclosure of such information took place for the purpose of it being disclosed to a foreign state, it is liable for imprisonment for a period not exceeding 15 years. Now, we believe that it appears that this clause was drafted to prevent state security agency employees, contractors, and sources from abusing their access to classified information. But if that was the intention, it isn't the result. Clearly, this doesn't apply only to employees of state security bodies, but also applies to any person. I mean, the phrase any person is written there very clearly. Now, the result is, if you read this in terms of all the other offenses contained in the bill, with regard to disclosure, with regard to possession, there's a two-tier system, a two-tier offense system that is created, in which the SSA is given more protection than any other body, including the other security custody bodies, that's police and defense. Now, in clause 43, which is our general disclosure clause, and we'll be coming to that, there is a limited amount of whistleblower protection for exposing a state secret. However, in clause 49, where that state secret belongs to the state security agency, there's number one, no whistleblower protection, and number two, a higher penalty for disclosing that information. Now, as a result, you can effectively, you can say that there's an additional layer of secrecy built up around the work of the security agency, which we believe is unjustifiable in terms of really of our constitution, or the values of our constitution. Now, number five, moving on, we've asked do not apply penalties for unauthorized disclosure at large, only those responsible for keeping secrets. We believe that the protection of state secrets is a matter which should concern the state, but should not be a burden on society as a whole. The state should protect its secrets at the source, and do not criminalize ordinary people for exercising constitutional right to access information and speak it freely when the state fails to, when the state fails its task of protecting that information. Now, during numerous interactions, and this has been an ongoing debate over the past few years around the bill, we've often heard from supporters of the bill and proponents of the bill and the bill's architects that the public interest defense, which is one of our key demands, being a key demand of civil society organizations and the public in general, does not apply anywhere else in the world. The claim that the public interest defense is sort of a mystical being that we're taking. Now, whether or not it's true that there is no public interest defense in other democracies such as ours, this argument ignores the reality that in many of those same countries, members of the public will not be prosecuted for possession or disclosure of classified information unless they are actually engaged in legitimate acts of espionage. So if we take the WikiLeaks example, a young officer in the U.S. military disclosed information, U.S. military information that showed human rights abuses to WikiLeaks. Well, he's accused of doing so. But the U.S. was not able to prosecute the website, media organizations, and the millions of ordinary citizens, including myself, who took possession of all that information. It would recognize that the U.S., that would constitute a breach of the First Amendment, which guarantees their freedom of expression. Now, they're currently attempting to prosecute the whistleblower.
You're saying including yourself?
Yes, sir.
Are you a citizen?
No, but I do possess the information that was on WikiLeaks.
Oh, I thought you were including yourself as a U.S. citizen. What happened?
Oh, no, sir, I'm not South African.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you wanted to bring my... No,
I just thought it was a South African.
What I was saying is that so far the U.S. is attempting to prosecute the whistleblower himself, which we believe is unjust. But we also recognize that in terms of the not particularly progressive legislation that the U.S. has on its books, they are not able to prosecute the people who receive that information, they're not able to prosecute the people who download that information, the news media, the broadcasters, and all the recipients of that information. They are protecting it at its source. Now, we acknowledge that the state may assume a slightly greater risk of exposing classified information where possession and disclosure of ordinary people is allowed. But that risk is far outweighed by the inclusion of the bill as it stands on ordinary people's right to access information and freedom of speech. And as we said, the bill will edge South Africa towards a society of secrets as soon as it imposes those responsibilities on us as citizens, and not as employees of the SSA. Moving on to 5.1, the possession and disclosure in the bill are criminalized. Now, clause 15 says a person who is in possession of a classified record, who communicates, delivers, and makes it available, needs to return it to can report the document to staff. Court 34 says any person who fails to comply with Section 15 is guilty of an offence and faces fines up to 5 years. Clause 42 says any person who unlawfully and unintentionally discloses the information constitutes the act of guilty of an offence. I'm summarising here, obviously. And clause 49 says any person who has in his possession or in his control information which is a security matter is guilty of an offence. So we have a person, any person, any person, any person. Now, fundamentally, we believe that these clauses should not apply to any person. We believe that it is the responsibility of employees, contractors, and sources of state security agencies to protect these secrets. It's not the responsibility of ordinary citizens. Just as in the US, they will attempt to prosecute their whistleblower, but at the very least, those of us who are exposed to that information are protected. And associated with that, and this is under Clause 5.2 in our submission, we are also deeply concerned that the harshness of the penalties, which are extraordinarily high in terms of the years in prison that they prescribe, sort of promote a culture of fear in which the free flow of information will be inhibited and exchanges will be discouraged. Moving on to Section 6, one of the key points that do not criminalize the legitimate disclosure of secrets in the public interest. We believe that any protection of state information should allow escape valves to balance ordinary citizens' right to access information, freedom of expression, within the state's national security mandate. And this is in the interest of an open and accountable policy. When we refer to escape valves, we mean a public interest defense. And this is especially important because of the way the bill, in its current form, may criminalize possession and disclosure of information. Appropriate whistleblower protection is the second point, and the third is appropriate access to information and declassification mechanisms. Now, we especially want to acknowledge that there have been a number of advances in the drafting of the bill with regard to those second two points, which my colleague will be calling up now. We want to acknowledge that those, with the latitude, there have been a number of important developments, but we do believe that there's still a distance to go. Our concern in the absence of the public interest defense, I think it has been well documented by a number of other civil society submissions that have been tabled here in the past 4 days. I don't want to lay the point. The proposals range from a defense that mirror the defense written into the PIO public interest override. There's another proposal for simple balancing act of the people's right to know against the punitive harmless disclosure. It's what I think the Nelson Mandela Foundation calls a harm test. But right to know is not interested in being prescriptive to this committee. These proposals form a solid basis, but we do urge the committee to work on this as a vital inclusion to the bill before any such legislation is passed. 6.2, on the whistleblower defense, there is a concern, and I think this is particularly well documented in the Open Democracy Advice Center submission, that the current whistleblower protection that is only applying to Clause 43 is extremely limited, almost a fig leaf of protection, because for limitations that are within the existing whistleblower law, the Protective Disclosures Act, which we'll go into briefly now. But secondly, of extreme importance, is that this defense in its current form reverses the onus, in that when someone makes a disclosure and is in danger of being criminalized in Clause 43, but may be protected in terms of the exemption in Clause 43, the onus is on them to prove their innocence rather than on the state to prove prove that what they did was harmful to national security. Now, there's been I don't want to labor the point on whistleblower protection. I think there's been a number of very useful formulations that have come up in the last 4 days. But just to briefly overview some of the clauses here that are sufficiently broad that they can be used to criminalize legitimate acts of whistleblowing. We have clause 43, after 5 years for disclosing a state secret unless your actions are covered by the PDA, Protected Disclosure Act, or the Companies Act. After 15 years for possessing or publishing information relating to state security, that's clause 49. After 20 years for communicating or copying information that is a state secret, if that information could prejudice the national security of the Republic, that is a rough paraphrase of clause 38. And after 25 years, if distributing information, if that information could directly or indirectly benefit a foreign state. Now that's obviously a crude summary of clause 36. Now we'll see in clause 36 that there's no exemption given for whistleblowers, and likewise in clause 38, in clause 49 the same. Now in clause 43 we do see a degree of protection for whistleblowers, and we want to join the other submissions who've raised this point just to highlight the fact that the Protective Disclosures Act is labor law. It was never written and it was never designed for this sort of protection, national security information. It's extremely limited protection because it applies only to you if you are blowing the whistle on your employer. It doesn't protect anyone who's not employed by that body who's making a legitimate disclosure. In other words, in clause 43, which is the only whistleblower protection we see, it actually only applies to civil service anyway. Now, even where a whistleblower may be protected by the PDA, and it should also be noted, and I'm sure the committee is familiar with the contents of the PDA, there's a very complicated procedure to follow if you intend to make a disclosure that in fact means it's complicated enough that you do require legal assistance almost all the time. But as someone is attempting to make a disclosure in terms of the PDA, they are in fact putting their counsel and their confidants at risk, because the protection they're given is not given to any kind of legal counsel that you may go to with the document to get advice, and it in fact doesn't even protect the whistleblower when they're making, for instance, a copy of the document that they're attempting to show to their lawyer. That is also criminalized within the bill. Now, moving on, I want to talk briefly about the provisions in this bill and how they relate to PIA. It's not clear in clauses 1931 and 32 why these clauses attempt to duplicate PIA. Now, PIA has a very well-established asset and protection regime, and already performs that balancing act. I think I do want to point the committee to the submission made by the South African History Archives, which goes into this in some detail. The threshold of the public interest in clause 43 is also too high, and this is in fact the weakness that we see in the Promotion of Access to Information Act, where the act says, excuse me, don't know why I just highlight this. The act says, the act says that I should find where I am in the act. Okay, the act says that essentially a head of an organ state must declassify information and grant a request for state information if I'm applying for it, if that state information reveals a substantial contravention or failure to comply with the law, or an imminent and serious public safety or environmental risk, and the public interest in the disclosure of the state information clearly outweighs the harm that will arise from this disclosure. Now, this is an attempt to create a balancing act for a head of state who wishes to provide access to a member of the public who's applying for access to it. But the problem here is that the threshold is too high, because, and we believe this is simply an oversight, they use the word and where they might have intended to use the word or. What happens is that an official who's reading this act to the letter may only release the information if an imminent and serious public safety or environmental risk is in place, and the public interest in the disclosure of the state information clearly outweighs the harm that will arise from the disclosure. We believe that that should be an or. If there's an environmental or public safety risk, or if the public interest outweighs the interest in withholding information, either of those is a good justification for releasing the information. Now, this is a weakness that is written into PIA. It's also a weakness that has been duplicated in this bill, and we think that the committee should maybe apply his mind to that, to that very complex sector. Now we, Chair, am I still good? No, I'm just hitting my stride. Chairperson, we had said that one of the other safety mechanisms that are vital where it comes to this concern was ensuring that there are good mechanisms for access to information. Now, Shireen is going to be discussing our concerns around the classification review panel, but something that relates more to concern six is that the classification review panel is not currently accessible to the public. If we wish to have information declassified that we believe is being incorrectly classified, our only recourse is to go to court. I'm surprised that it's a well-resourced organization. I personally don't represent a well-resourced organization, and I know the member of the public, the courts are essentially beyond my reach and beyond the reach of most people in this country. It's one of the facts that we live with. Now, we believe that the classification review panel should be open to consider appeals from the public as an alternative to the court appeal. And we believe that it shouldn't be an and or. This is a good opportunity to ensure that this review panel is available as an independent panel that is a recourse to citizens. I think that wraps me up for section six. I'll pass over to Shireen for section seven, and then we'll wrap up that.
The ICNO believes that the Minister of State Security is not the appropriate authority to adjudicate classification and declassification decisions in other state departments, as there is likely to be a bias in the favor of secrecy. We welcome the proposed establishment of the Classification Review Panel. However, Chapter 7, which deals with the Classification Review Panel, reveals that there are a number of deficiencies which confirms the view that the panel will be an extension of the State Security Agency and not be sufficiently independent to remedy the original problem of the minister as arbiter. The minister's concurrence in the panel's regulating function suggests the lack of independence. The Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence being in charge of the nomination process may increase the bias towards secrecy among selected candidates for the panel, and the minister's appointment of the members suggests they will not be independent of him. Furthermore, the Joint Standing Committee being put in charge of procedures related to the removal of members and the minister's powers related to suspension and removal suggests that the panel will be an extension of the State Security Agency and not independent. Instead, a two-thirds majority in the National Assembly to endorse removal decisions, such as in the case of an independent institution like the public protector, may be more appropriate.
That goes quicker than I think it's going to be. Chairperson, thank you very much. I'm wrapping up now. We have additional concerns which we've so far followed a thematic approach. These are just some final additional concerns that are not by any means exhaustive, but we did want to raise them. Concern 8.1 with regards to espionage and hostile activities offenses, I think there's been much ink spilled on these clauses and many words passed back and forth just in the past 4 days. So I'm not going to belabor this point. But what I do want to draw your attention to is in 3.6 and 3.8, and all the sub clauses that are attached to it. Just to summarize briefly, it says it's an offense punishable on conviction of imprisonment for a period not less than 15 years, not exceeding 25 years, to unlawfully and intentionally communicate, deliver, or make available state information. To unlawfully and intentionally make, obtain, collect, and capture information, then under 20 year penalties. Unlawfully and intentionally communicate, unlawfully and intentionally make, obtain, collect, capture, etc. And now we do acknowledge that this is in fact, if we're looking at the way this bill has been drafted and the history of its drafting, we acknowledge that the word intentionally was inserted during the National Assembly's deliberation, in response to complaints, the provisions may be open to abuse. But it appears that the insertion was actually was done incorrectly and with an unintended consequence. The word intentionally is in fact inserted in the wrong place. Intentionally is attached here to the action of communicating, delivering, or receiving the information, rather than the purpose for which the action is taken, which would be in an act of espionage to benefit a foreign state. What is important here is that a whistleblower or anyone making a legitimate disclosure of information that is in the public interest does so intentionally. They certainly communicate intentionally. They certainly obtain it intentionally and they deliver it intentionally. But it is not their intention when they do so to benefit a foreign state or to prejudice national security. And these clauses currently don't make that distinction. And in doing so, clauses that are drafted to tackle espionage are drafted to tackle what are referred to as hostile activities against the state are broad enough that they in fact cover legitimate acts of whistleblowing as well. And this is a fairly simple drafting change, but I think it's vital. An example of how this may work, an anti-corruption campaigner obtains classified records describing the acquisition of a major weapon system. The records reveal that no tender procedure was followed, twice the market value of the weapons is being paid. And the campaigner decides to take the risk of the up to 5 years jail sentence for disclosing this information as per Clause 43 and publishes the document on a website, let's say, for instance, Corruption Watch. An enterprising prosecutor sees this and decides to charge the campaigner not under Clause 43, but with espionage. And they can do so because Clause 36.1 clearly says that the campaigner knows or ought to have known that the disclosure would directly or indirectly benefit a foreign state. In this case, because as a byproduct of the disclosure, a foreign state is now aware of the weapon system that we've just acquired. And it's certainly not the intention of the campaign to benefit the foreign state, but he or she should have known and now faces, you know, penalties of up to 25 years in jail as a spy, rather than even the maximum of 5 that was originally intended in the legislation, which I would argue is still too harsh a penalty. Now, example 2, an employee of the SAP Crime Intelligence Service comes across classified records in the course of her duties, showing a top secret operation against a major drug lord. The same records show that the head of crime intelligence, who's supposed to be overseeing the operation, is in the drug lord's pocket, which is obviously clearly hypothetical. After following the procedures prescribed in the CDA, the Protective Disclosure Act, and believing herself to be covered by the whistleblower protection, the limited whistleblower protection that we've already referred to, she blows the whistle by handing the records to a member of parliament such as herself. But an enterprising prosecutor, again realizing that the police officer is likely to claim whistleblower protection, decides to charge her not under Clause 43, but under the hostile activities offense, which is Clause 38. And he can do so because under the current wording of Section 38.1a, our staff officer knows or ought to reasonably have known that her actions would directly or indirectly prejudice the national security. And again, it was not the intention to prejudice the national security when she made the disclosure, but she might have to admit that the byproduct of her disclosure was that the drug lord got to know what was coming and managed to evade arrest. In that event, she's unable to claim whistleblower protection and is exposed to a very severe prison sentence. Now, we believe these are unintended consequences and the root of the espionage and hostile activities offenses may be avoided by a very simple redrafting that this committee can undertake. Section 8.2, and you'll be glad to know that this is our final point, although there are other points raised in our submission that we haven't raised here because we believe that the committee has got a fair sense of what our concerns are now. 8.2 is the harboring and concealing clause. The bill provides, I cannot read it at this distance, I'm going to read from here. Any person who harbors or conceals a person whom he or she knows or has reasonable grounds to believe or suspect has committed or is about to commit an offense in Section 36 or 38 that has been armed for hostile activities is guilty of an offense and liable to conviction, to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 10 years. Now, as long as Sections 36 and 38 are sufficiently broadly drafted that they may, in fact, criminalize a legitimate act of whistleblowing, we believe that this clause is particularly harsh. Because in doing so, it criminalizes not only the whistleblowers, but potentially their families as well. And the inclusion of reasonable grounds to believe or suspect is so broad as to really ensnare almost anyone who comes into contact with someone who may or may not at some point be allowed to commit an act of illegal whistleblowing. So we believe that this clause, I don't think it's been raised in the submissions until now in any detail, but I just wanted to highlight that as a particular concern. Now this brings us to our conclusion, and thank you very much for your time, honorable members. I think that something that I just want to say in summary is that we've already said we acknowledge the need to replace the apartheid era legislation. We certainly acknowledge the need to replace the minimum information standard, document, which has been in place since 1996. And we legitimately accept the need of our democracy to protect certain information as secret as a national security imperative. But we fundamentally believe that this law, through a variety of means, through unintentional drafting, and through, I think, an overly securitized frame of mind, has got the balance wrong between the citizen's right to access information, the citizen's right to an open democracy, and the state's security, the state's imperative to protect its national security. Now, as a country, we have a number of very progressive pieces of legislation in place, a number of very progressive provisions and initiatives. One of them is PIA, one of them is the Protect Disclosure Act, which are meant to ensure an open democracy. But if you look at the way, so I'm just getting to the end of my opening remarks. If you look at the Promotion of Access to Information Act, which guarantees us our right to know, and if you see how PIA in the past 10 years has consistently frustrated citizens' attempts to access information, not only from government but the private sector, where 25% of PIA applications receive any kind of response, not even a no response whatsoever, you can see that our right to access information it has yet to be fulfilled in terms of the existing legislation. If you look at the promotion, the Protecting Disclosures Act, which is meant to promote the rights of whistleblowers to have the courage to speak out, and you realize that today most whistleblowers who do speak out will, if they're lucky, pay for it with losing their jobs. They may face harassment, they may face criminal penalties, and we see in certain cases they face real physical danger. We realize that we've not reached a place where whistleblowers are protected by our society. And we urge this committee to take the historic opportunity that has been given to reform this legislation, because at the moment it communicates a message, unintentionally or intentionally, it communicates a message that these rights can be further eroded, when in fact we need to take the society forward, and we need to take the right to know in small caps forward as a nation. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Now, thank you very much, the collective leadership of Right to Know, with your presentation. Maybe before I just allow members to engage, I just, your last concern, maybe you could just quickly respond to that one. If I were to house, who's that, the special chance? Master? No, better. Not Margaret, but Mark. Yes, Mark. If I were to house Mark, as a friend, but later on, after 2 days, I then realized, hey, this guy is very strange, and they always have their separate meetings there. And then later on, I realized that, hey, man, these guys are bringing in weapons, or they are putting something together here. And later on, he discloses to me that they are planning to send mercenaries to Equatorial Guinea they're plotting to overthrow that government. And because of it, my friend, I keep quiet about it. And it so happens, he does that. And it causes real stress between South Africa and Guinea. What would be the right to know's position in that? Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think that's a very good question. So before we take other questions, I'd like to address it. Firstly, I would feel very sorry for you, Chairperson, if you had to have Mark Batch as a hostage. But that notwithstanding, I think that our concern here is not where you're intentionally harboring someone who's about to commit a coup d'etat in an African state. Our concerns are two-tiered. The first is that there will be times where it's not Mark Thatcher who's criminalized in terms of Section 36 and 38, but those who have no such ill intent. But the second, and this is where I urge caution with the drafting of that clause, is that the person housing Mark Thatcher won't always be such as yourself of kind of firm-minded temperament. What if it's a granny who believes the best in everyone, who happens to be renting out a room to the dishonorable Mark Thatcher? That granny is as liable to prosecution as you would be, so if she fails to realize that she was having a meeting with a bunch of mercenaries in her house. Thank you.
Very much. Another member? Another Bloom?
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the presentation from Right to Know. My first question will be on their first page, the introduction. I really want to understand who is Right to Know, because it's very vague. And is Right to Know established to when this bill was introduced, or is it an old? Give me the history of Right to Know. That is the first question. Chairperson, the second one is that, you know, since Tuesday, and I think you have raised it as well yesterday, you know, since Tuesday, groups are coming to make presentations, raise concerns, but they are not helping the committee with when you are saying that this clause is not right, come with a formulation, help us to formulate and do it better. When we are meeting, then we will say that Right to Know has said this or this organization, but it does not help us to raise concern and not come with alternatives. That is it. Now I'm going to your, let me see, where you are saying that everything on intelligence do not exempt the intelligence agencies from public scrutiny. Now there is a committee here in Parliament, Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, and I know that they are doing oversight over the intelligence agencies from all over. They, crime intelligence, everybody is there. Yeah, a multi-party one. Thank you very much. Yes, my advocate, actually. Advocate Bumi. Yeah. Now, you see, I have asked this question several times to Bonnie here. Maybe you can help us or come up with a response. How do you balance transparency with secrecy? Maybe you can assist, because then you will help us if you can come up with that. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable Chairman.
No, thanks, Chair. Let me first appreciate the presentation and indicate that for the first time I hear what Right to Know is saying. And by so saying, I don't necessarily say mean I agree with all that you have submitted. But at least I hear you for the first time. And I'm saying for the first time because you have at least been part of all the hearings in the regions where we attended. And I couldn't hear anything from you except distortion. Today, and I'm coming to the point of distortion. Today, I'm hearing you because I can also see that there's a tremendous shift in terms of what you have been presenting throughout the public hearing and what you are tabling here today. And I very much appreciate that, because that is what you have been saying. Give us the facts. Don't just be too broad and general and confuse the people, which is a concern that I've always been having. And I hope that today you will be bold enough here to come out of the woods and begin to say things in a clear voice like you have said now, so that we deal with the confusion that some of us believe your organization has caused. I'm saying that precisely because of the shift that I'm saying is there. Because if one reads the small red documents that were being circulated all over, the right to know was outrightly saying reject this chief. But today you say the right to know campaign is a nationwide coalition of people and organizations opposed to state protection of state information being in its current form, In other words, meaning you do not have a problem with the state having to protect, manage its information, but you've got a problem with those things that you have raised today. Something that the majority of your people and supporters, including those who are here today, could not understand before, and I hope they understand it today. That it is the right of the state to protect and manage and act in the best interest of people, including yourself. Now, that is the point that I wonder if you'll be bold enough to say, honorable member, on that point I do agree with you, that is how it is. Because already you have made that acknowledgement. You went further to say, we acknowledge the significant changes already brought about in the deliberations of the National Assembly, which have resulted as much from people's struggles as from good sense on the part of political actors across the political spectrum, inside and outside of Parliament, as well as on the part of the architects of this bill. Which, and then you say, which by definition, you also further acknowledge the work that has been done, and by extending some of the amendments that you appreciate could have included your former concern. Something again, if one is to take you back to the submissions that your organization was doing during public hearing, needs to be corrected. Because those people are left with the idea that this is a demonic piece of legislation that needs to be rejected with everything that the people have. You see? Hence my initial statement that today I can hear what you are saying. But I'm coming in at the point of wanting to raise and expose the distortions and the confusion that the right to know could have caused, intentionally or unintentionally. But from where I sit here, I am convinced that it was intentional to confuse people, ordinary people, who don't understand law, to say things that they don't understand, when key leaders of the organization correctly understand what we are trying to do and why this process, because the process was open precisely to listen to the people. Not all the things that are happening in the country where you are taking petitions for people to sign that this state now wants to bring everything under carpet, you are not going to have access to information. Yet today, you are acknowledging and appreciating, including making references to promotion of access of information as one piece of legislation that also speaks to regulation of classified information. You are also telling us examples about the number of documents that have been classified. So there's nothing new or nothing as a secret, because you acknowledge that there should be secrets. But you will have a problem with certain clear areas as you have contained in your document today. Hence, I can hear you. So, Chair, I don't have a question to them, because on issues of legal matters, some are repetitions just of all those things that everybody else has just said. It's just an emphasis on those areas. And it would be a waste of time for one to study that. But the point that I want to pose is whether the three leaders as they are seated here will be bold enough to accept that, yes, if one is to take this presentation and the manner in which we have been doing things as we come to public hearings and all those other committees, it could be that enough damage has been done to confuse people. Because some of us, from political perspective, we don't take time to even see the organization having people like yourself who can articulate positions. But when they articulate this position in a wrong manner, they put other people at front to say wrong things. Because in the minds of anybody, it's like, if I may be blind, black people can't think, only whites can think. Because in our organization, and you can tell that is not what I want to embarrass anybody. By just picking one of the right to know members who are here and say, can you articulate these things in the way that the gentleman has done? Would you be embarrassed? I thank you, Chair.
Okay, but let's ignore the last part, because we have said this is a committee meeting. So it would not be correct even to think of pointing at anybody who is not a presenter and who is not a member of the committee, because this is an extension. Members of the public are not allowed to participate. Okay, so that last part is... But it was ready to help. I've recognized the number of Matisse.
Yes, sir.
Okay. You are recognized now. No, the only point that I wanted to raise is I appreciate what you've been raised here. But this is a clear shift from what you did in George. Because what you are telling us today, it's not what you said to us in George. Is it? And this is the point that I think Honorable Chan, because you were in George with some people in our first public hearing. And that's why we are wondering, why did you mislead the nation in terms of the issues you are raising now? These are genuine issues, are proper issues.
Honorable members.
This is not a tribunal. Let's not put the right to know in a difficult platform. It's a civil society organization, it campaigned, it did whatever it did, it told the people that this act seeks to cover up corruption, it seeks to do what, to do what, to do what. It's what they did out there. What they did there, there's got no bearing on what they're doing now. Here is an official position or platform to afford the right to tell us exactly what are the areas where they think we've got problems with the people. We have listened to them. Let us treat them like any other organization that has made presentations. Let's ask questions to what they have presented. Please, what has happened outside, let it be outside there. If you want to engage them at a political level, that can happen outside there. But for now, can we just focus on the presentation of the time to know in terms of their presentation? Correct. No, I'm not calling you to order.
I just want to correct the point that says anything that happened outside. The point that you are raising did not happen outside. They happen in formal parliamentary processes, public hearings. And public hearings are accorded the same status as these meetings. So they were not set anywhere outside, but it was informal proceedings of parliament. That's what I'm talking to. I thank you.
No, that's fine. I understand that point. It happened in George, it happened in Umlazi, it happened in the Eastern Cape, it happened everywhere where we were. And the right to know made presentations
But those presentations were of a program, and that was the provincial public hearing process. This is now an internal process. Well, what if they have shifted? So be good. So be it. That's good. That's wonderful. It was worrying in the manner in which the right to know was presenting their issues in all these public hearings. But extremely negative. It is true. It's a fact. We were insulted. We were told all these sorts of things by people wearing the right to know t-shirt, by people who presented themselves as coordinators of right to know. But hospitals were not harmed. The department harmed. We took the insult. Now there's a shift. It's a positive thing. Very good. I'm happy. At least now we know where the right to know stands. So anybody, even in my province, who can stand up and say that he's representing, he or she's representing the right to know, and the right to know is against the bill because the bill is there to cover corruption? I tell that person you are wrong. That's not what the right to know is saying. These are the issues that the right to know is talking about in relation to the bill. So that person would not be representing the right to know. That person would be representing something else. So I think that, to me, I appreciate this opportunity. I appreciate this clarity. That's very good. I'm very clear now. She good?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I just want to ask a little clarity question. What's your relationship with this department, Chair?
Okay, another word.
Thank you, Chair, and I'd also like to thank the right to know in your presentation. And otherwise, to some of our other colleagues, I thank you for your support in our public hearings around the country. So don't be intimidated. Certainly don't be intimidated. What I'd like to know is, you made a reference in your presentation to fire. You know, the bill in its present format overrules fire. But you did also state that even with fire, when you made applications for certain documentation, only about 25% has been agreed to. Could you confirm it? What do you think of fire as it is? For argument's sake, if we had to reverse the clause that this new proposal overrides fire and we put fire back? I'm just asking what Rossman's opinion is on that.
No, thank you very much, Honorable Wolf. You know, you remind me of something that I've always asked you, because we're in all these public hearings together. And I kept on asking you, what is your relationship with the right to know? As a CAC. And you kept on saying, no, it's an independent organ of civil society. Now you're telling them where we supported you. That's an interesting confession. I just wanted to go to, before I give the right to know. Oh, no. They have not even answered. From, are you calling me to answer?
You have also become as a spokesperson of right to know. You are saying you will go out in Kimberley and Northern Cape and preach the gospel of right to know.
Well, I'm saying I will correct anybody who then says this bill seeks to protect corruption at the position of the right to know, because that's not the position of the right to know. That one I will correct. Okay. No. Let's one or two things quickly before we give you an opportunity to respond. You speak of the independence of the review panel, and make the statement that the minister will appoint the members of the panel. Can I be clarified on that? Because the way I read the act says it will be an open participatory process where the public would be allowed to make nominations, and there is a committee that will also be established by people of particular expertise and so forth, who will be accountable to Parliament. And I thought by virtue of accounting to Parliament,
it therefore characterizes that panel as an independent panel, because for obvious reasons, if it accounts to Parliament, it means Parliament would solve it. If Parliament funds it or recommends for its funding, it means that money will be coming from the fiscal. And if it comes from the fiscal, it means that they are accountable to the people of the Republic and not to anybody else. But yes, it supports the minister to set up the regulator. Under those, with that understanding, can you point to the extent to which you strongly feel that it is not going to be independent? Because the way I read the current bill, it makes the independent review panel an independent body. Yes, of course, I take the point of access and how we restructure it to be accessible to ordinary people and so forth and so on. But the issue of the independence, it was quite worrying. You close 50. No. Here's the second issue, which is quite an interesting issue to me. Because, you see, when you open, in your opening remark, you recognize the state's ability or right to keep secrets, whether it be security or, let's say, security secrets, the cluster, police, defense, intelligence, and so forth. But then further down, you say, the public must be allowed an opportunity to comment on matters of secrecy. Now, how do you balance the two? On the one hand, you say the state has got the right to secret, whether it be security or what. Of course, you have isolated other areas that you think should not form part of the secrecy that the state is entitled to. But at the same time, you say that the public must be allowed to comment. How do you balance that? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to respond to the issue of the background of the RATINO. RATINO was formed in 2008. It did not exist. It only started organizing and formulating itself after the public hearing that took place in 2010. When we saw that seems like the bill, you know, might be passed soon, and we thought let's call upon civil society organizations and form, you know, the coalition that we are. And it's formed by a number of civil society organizations, more than 400 civil society organizations, and several thousand individuals. And it did not exist before the discussion on the protection of
security.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry, on the issue of the public hearing that took place, our Ngugulethu. Yeah, sure.
But Chairperson, it should be acknowledged that we've come here to engage in the technical aspects of the bill. We've not come here for campaigning purposes, and I think that I'm concerned that some of these questions and comments will draw us into that region. I do think it should be put on record, Chairperson, that the 7-point freedom test, those are the 7 points that we've raised here, were the basis of our original statement, which was published August 31st, endorsed by over 400 civil society organizations, tens of thousands of individual South Africans. That has been our position from the very beginning. There's no shift yet. Our position on the bill has shifted as the bill has shifted. There's no sudden arrival in Parliament and a turnaround of our position. I think it needs to acknowledge that, in fact, we do reject the bill in its current form, and we will reject any bill that doesn't meet those 7 points, because we do believe that that will create an enabling environment for greater restrictions on access to information, greater penalties on the rights of whistleblowers, and in fact a greater society of secrets. And I think that needs to acknowledge that this continues to be opposition. And so, I'm going to leave it at that.
I'm also just on a note, I've been asked by Shirin to note this, that there was a question on why, I think it was all the member Bloom has asked us why we haven't offered many prescriptive solutions. We have offered some in Texas, but it needs to be acknowledged that the Right to Know campaign, as Kwame has raised, is a coalition of several hundred organizations and thousands and thousands of people. What we present here is a consensus group of concerns. We don't want to be prescriptive to the committee, but more importantly, we are a broad church, and so we have broad concerns. There are a number of organizations that have made very prescriptive and possibly very useful submissions to this committee. I know, for instance, on the, I think SANEP has done some drafting, and others, you know, I've been in and out of these meetings. So I hope those questions are dealt with. Now, on the question of whether or not the State Security Agency and all of the State Security should be protected from public scrutiny or not. I think if the committee will indulge me, I would like to just quickly cite a monograph by the academic professor Sandy Africa, who specializes in intelligence services, in a book called Well Kept Secrets, Access to Information in the South African Intelligence Structure. She writes, in 2009, before this bill was proposed in council, it appears that both the intelligence services and relevant policymakers have been ambiguous about how appropriate and meaningful levels of transparency should be pursued, and under what conditions the services may invoke a right to secrecy. A more pessimistic analysis would be that the way in which the intelligence services have retreated into justification of secrecy, even where greater openness and public disclosure would not have threatened national security, displays a significant continuity with the apartheid past. Now, she's referring there specifically to state security structures, not to the rest of government. But I think that foundational to the Right to Know's our launch in 2010 was an understanding that there are some secrets that must be kept. The problem we have in the current climate is that the intelligence structures currently have no it appears to have no ability to balance their core national security responsibilities and broader transparency and accountability to the public. An example would be that the intelligence services don't produce an annual report that is available to the public. They in fact have an exemption from the Promotion Act, the Information Act. There was an example cited last year of an academic named Jane Duncan, who wrote to the SSA requesting copies of operational policy of the intelligence services, and was denied access to the policy, not the method, and not the actual operations themselves. We just want a broad framework of information that is useful to us. The same academic has pointed us towards the Dutch security services, who are not a progressive group of people. They've been known to harass left-wing groups in Holland. They've been known to turn a blind eye to the real national security threat of the right-wing groups currently in the Netherlands, called Braunschweig. These are not people that we wish to emulate. But what the Dutch intelligence services do have is a progressive approach providing access of a certain degree of information to the public that keeps them relatively accountable to the public, that keeps the public relatively informed on the debate surrounding what our national security priorities are, what the role of the national security structures are within our democracy, how much money they're spending, what are they doing, what are their priorities, and so on and so forth. And that includes, for instance, making information publicly available through Parliament, making a degree of information available to the public, where there's no free flow of information, there's no public oversight. And remember that public oversight of the intelligence services is almost non-existent in this country. We do have the legislative oversight proposed by the JSCI, which has been raised here. Our concerns with the JSCI are drawn on well-documented concerns that committee meets behind closed doors, and it effectively is not an oversight body because there's no information flowing from that body to the public about what the intelligence services are. And so what we're asking for is a balancing act between national security and access to information. I don't think that's unreasonable. Chairperson, you yourself asked, you yourself asked about the committee, the panel, about our concerns about the panel's independence and the minister's involvement in that. Just a note I've made here. I understand your statement that Parliament has a role in overseeing the committee, but what you see is that the panel is still almost subjunctive to the SSA and the ministry itself. At the moment, the ministry is involved in the paying of salaries, is giving responsibility to the panel's budget, and is responsible for setting regulations that the panel must follow, and technically appoint the panel itself and suspend it on the recommendation of this Joint Planning Committee on Intelligence. But nonetheless, it is appointing on their nomination and is responsible for suspending members of the panel. Now, we believe that this panel, if it is an independent body, must not be connected to the SSA and the ministry at all. It's an oversight body and not just an undersight body as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members. I see members wanting to make follow-ups. I'm worried about time. Our critique, and I keep the critique, and I critique myself as well, and members again are doing the same what they did yesterday. And you may run into that same problem, because at 12 o'clock I'll be getting notes that my flight is in the next hour, and so forth. So can you avoid that? All right. Thank you very much, Right to Know. And the question of Honorable Donald, your relationship with the minister.
Thank you. I believe that we've already communicated about this at the hearing at George. Honorable member, the Foundation for Human Rights is one of our funders, which will be published on our website. The Foundation for Human Rights receives funding through the Department of Justice. Thank you.
Thank you very much to the Right to Know Coalition of Civil Society Organization, and I want to thank you, Hart, for even creating a better understanding of the fair. Now I know who is the Right to Know and what it stands for. And of course, yes, you gave us an interesting time in our provinces. You know, the way I was angry at some point, I said to myself, the day they come to Parliament, the first thing I'm going to ask or demand from them is an apology. Because we call fat cat thieves, all these derogatory names and all that in this public area. Nevertheless, that's why we are public representatives, probably. To take all these things and be strong. Okay, thank you very much for your time and for the valuable contribution that you've made. We will definitely be using and considering, especially those concrete proposals you're making in relation to specific issues where you would want to see some improvement and so forth. We will be in touch on any matter if there's any need for better clarity. Thank you very much, sir. Okay. Honourable members, the next presentation is from the, you know, I said this morning that since yesterday we are very much less at Honourable Bloom. We are very much less at this week. Now today we are receiving a presentation from the Catholic Bishop. Okay. Bishop Mike, or Advocate, who's making the presentation? Oh, okay. We are all yours. It's 20 to 11 now. You'll guide us.
We are all yours. Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. We will try to be quick. I have with me this morning Archbishop Stephen Brisbane, who is the Archbishop of Cape Town, and also the Vice President of the Southern African Catholic Bishops Conference. Archbishop Brisbane will shortly just say a few words about why, in general terms, this legislation is of concern to the Church, And then after that, I will present our submission in more detail. I also have with me, behind me, one of the researchers in our office, Professor Sipuma. I want to say one or two quick words of introduction, because we do not appear all that often before the committees of the National Council of Provinces. Since 1997, when the bishops set up a parliamentary liaison office, we have appeared, I don't know how many times, 50 or 60 times perhaps, before the committees of the National Assembly on a whole range of legislation. And on a few occasions also over the years before Council of Provinces committees, but we don't come that often. So it's a pleasure for us to be here before you and to try to make some small contribution to this very important piece of legislation. So I say we have an office here in Cape Town which attempts to express the views and concerns and suggestions of the Catholic Church on a range of matters of legislation and public policy. Church is always concerned to make a contribution to a better life for everyone in society and to offer, from our perspective of gospel values and the Church's own social understanding and social principles, our comments and what insights we have to Parliament and to government so that hopefully legislation and policy can benefit to some extent. So now I'll ask Archbishop Wilson simply to say a few words about why we're concerned about this particular piece of legislation.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chairperson and honourable members. I am standing in today for Archbishop Buti Lakhali, the president of the Southern African Catholic Bishops Conference, who could not be here. As the Catholic Church in South Africa, we wish to raise concerns about certain aspects of the Protection of State Information Bill. We do so as members of civil society, but also because we believe that certain values which we cherish could be compromised by the bill in its present form. The South African Constitution speaks of the values of human dignity, equality, and freedom. And these are values which we as the Catholic Church take very seriously, in common with the whole of the faith community. We believe that all people are imbued with dignity by virtue of having been made by God and in the image of God. We believe that all people are loved and cherished equally by God, and that we should therefore relate to each other on the basis of equality. And we believe that God has given us the freedom to make choices, to decide how to live our lives according to our consciences. This is indeed a sacred freedom, and one that must be treasured and protected. The right to information is a vital part of the promotion of these three core values in society, the values of human dignity, equality, and freedom. If information is unduly withheld from us, we do not really have the freedom we need in order to exercise our rights. And if some in society are unable to exercise their rights fully, then there is a situation of inequality between them and others. And clearly, if a citizen cannot access information, let's say there's information about a housing waiting list, or information about what appears to be corruption in a municipality, then that citizen's dignity is being undermined. He or she is in fact being treated like a child, being told by officials, "We know better. We will decide what you should know and what we should hide from you." There are some aspects of the Protection of State Information Bill that threaten all three of these values of human dignity, equality, and freedom. Firstly, it allows too much to be hidden from the public. Secondly, unintentionally, it may allow corruption and maladministration to be covered up. And thirdly, it will create a situation of inequality between between well-placed people who have access to important information and others who do not have the same access to information. So it is precisely because the Catholic Church, along with our country's constitution, places so much value on human dignity, equality and freedom that we wish to express our misgivings about anything that compromises or threatens those values. I would like to thank you for this opportunity for the Catholic Church to present our concerns to the committee. I give over to Advocate Mark.
Joseph, let me begin by saying that we have followed the processes of this bill through Parliament over the last few years. As you know, it first came before Parliament in 2008 in a somewhat different form. We made a submission then to the National Assembly Committee, and then when it was brought back to Parliament in 2010, again we made a submission then, and we have watched how the bill has changed shape. We've watched and been very impressed by the way in which the National Assembly Committee engaged and sought consensus as far as possible. The way in which both members of the governing party and the opposition parties in that committee were able to reach significant areas of agreement, and the way in which the committee engaged with members of civil society and civil society organizations was an excellent advertisement for our parliamentary democracy. We hope very much, and we have great faith, that the proceedings of this committee are going to echo what happened there, and that there will be every attempt to improve the book further, and to allow everybody, as you have done over these last few days, to contribute to the best of their ability. It is entirely possible, we believe, that an excellent piece of legislation can emerge from these hearings, and we really urge you to do everything that you can to reach agreement and consensus, so that we can go forward with a very useful piece of legislation that hopefully will not end up in court. In all of the hearings, going back to 2008 and even up until yesterday, it has been said a number of times by various people making submissions and in the media by commentators and so on, that this bill is going to take us back to the past, to a dark time in our history, to the days of the Internal Security Act and the Apartheid Security State, etc. This is an exaggeration, a serious exaggeration, and it's not helpful. Our constitution, our democracy, our courts, our civil society are all robust. And this process is proof of that. This very long process that this bill has been going through is proof of that. And while we must always be alert to things that threaten our core values, as Archbishop has pointed out, and we don't overlook those threats at all, we must also not overstate them, and we must not make the mistake of thinking that the South Africa of 2012 is in any shape or form similar to the South Africa of those dark days. And anyone who lived through those days and campaigned through those days back towards the end of apartheid in the 1980s, certainly in days of the state of emergency, will know that you cannot compare. And to make those exaggerated claims is unfortunate because it leads to a hardening of attitudes. It leads perhaps also to an over-politicization of some of these important issues. And different parties then feel that they have to stake their position and reject the idea of compromise, consensus, accommodation, because now we have to defend certain positions. And so we would want to warn against some of those exaggerated claims. And I was very happy yesterday to hear Advocate Beaver himself also expressing the view that it doesn't make much sense to talk of this legislation as taking us back to those dark days. Having said that, because I'm a lawyer, I always have to say having said that, and on the other hand, we must be concerned. We must be concerned, and we must point to the specific areas that we think do threaten our values. And we have outlined in our written submission 5 points. That's not everything, but at this stage of your hearing, it's not necessary for us to try to repeat everything that everybody has said. So I'm going to try to concentrate on those 5 points and be as quick as I can. firstly, right at the beginning, the definition of national security. It's a great improvement on previous definitions, but in our view, it's still not good enough. It still opens the way for organs of state to add all sorts of other acts or threats that are not mentioned in the definition, because it starts off with the word include. So it says national security includes, and then there's a list. And it's an open list by virtue of that word includes. Honourable Mr. Bloom has asked for specific suggestions. We make a very simple, straightforward, specific section, suggestion. Change the word includes to means. And then you limit that list. It's already a long list. So you're not going to pull the carpet from under the feet of the security agency. But you are going to prevent unwarranted additions to that list. Very simple step. Secondly, clause 1.4, which deals with the conflict of laws, and again this has been raised, certainly was raised yesterday by the Legal Resources Centre. This is the one that says that if there is a conflict with the Promotion of Access to Information Act, then this Act must prevail. We echo what has been said by some of the other presenters. Quite simply, PIA is a more superior piece of legislation to any ordinary legislation of Parliament. The three acts that were passed in 2000 to give effect to constitutional rights, PIA being one of them, the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, and the Promotion of Equality and Prohibition of Unfair Discrimination Act. All three of those acts are seen in constitutional terms as having greater weight and a higher standing, if you will, than other ordinary legislation, precisely because they were enacted on a constitutional mandate to give effect to those rights. And what that means in our submission is that if this act, when it becomes an act, attempts simply to override, to stand superior to PIA, it is attempting to stand superior to Section 32 of the Constitution, and it cannot do that. If it constitutes de facto an amendment to Section 32 of the Constitution, not just a limitation, and it cannot do that. We believe that the Court would probably rule that unconstitutional. Simple solution again, in our view, delete Clause 1.4. Once again, you will not unduly undermine this piece of legislation, because the provisions within PIA for the protection of classified information are strong. They're not weak provisions at all. So there's quite simply no need for you to make this law, or to pretend that this law can be superior to PIA. PIA contains safeguards against the distribution of classified information. Nothing more than that is needed in our view. Move on to clause 3, which also has been dealt with at some length by others, so I won't dwell on it. The application of the Act. The Act is made applicable, of course, made ordinarily applicable to the three major security agencies of the country, the police, security, intelligence services, and the defense force. And then Section 32B makes it possible to extend that on application to the minister, to other organs. This is something that should happen only in the most extraordinary of circumstances, if at all. And we suggest that Clause 3 to be as far too wide and widely framed. There's a proviso that says on good cause shown. We don't believe that that sets the threshold high enough. It should be specified that the request for classification must be made by the head of the organ of state concerned, and not, as it is presently said, by any part thereof. In other words, if a ministry feels the need to apply to the intelligence minister for a classification, then it must be the minister of that other ministry, not just a ministerial department official. So it's something which should occur only at the very highest level, and that presupposes, of course, a careful discretion or exercise of discretion on the part of the minister, that the minister, the political head of that organization, has really put his or her mind to the question. Rather than that it becomes almost a rubber stamp sort of thing, where relatively low-level officials can simply make these applications willy-nilly all the time, almost as a habit. Furthermore, classification provisions should apply only to specified items or categories of information and should not be delegated in their entirety to other organs of state. In other words, if a municipality or a parastatal, for example, decides that it wants to have some information classified, it must show right at the beginning of the process in its application that this information falls into one of those categories of top secret or secret or whatever. So all of our suggestions all along there are a way of limiting, in a sense, to limit the extension of the power to classify as far as possible. Yesterday, the Legal Resources Centre suggested to you that Section 32B should simply be deleted after the book. If you were to choose to do that, we would certainly support it. But we would be prepared to recognise that there may very occasionally be circumstances where someone other than the security agency may have a legitimate need to classify. But it must be in the most extraordinary circumstances. And to put it quite frankly, it must be difficult for them to do that. The threshold must be set high. We suggest some particular wording that may satisfy our suggestion there. And we've put in our written submission that the provisions may be made applicable by the minister for substantial and compelling reasons and with reference to specified items or categories of information. So that compares to the existing 32B in the following way. The existing one says may be made applicable by the minister on good cause shown. We are saying not just good cause, but only if there are substantial and compelling reasons and with reference to specified items or categories. This clause, substantial and compelling, has a particular legal meaning, as members may be aware. It appears in clause 36.4 of the bill, as it stands at the moment, where we're dealing with offences and penalties. It says that if a court is satisfied that substantial and compelling circumstances exist, it may deviate from the minimum sentence. The whole idea of substantial and compelling came into our law in the Criminal Law Amendment Act 105 of 1997, the so-called Minimum Sentences Act, where the courts are enjoined to impose minimum sentences on people for certain serious offences unless there are substantial and compelling reasons not to. And the reason why we suggest that you could make use of that phrase in this law is that there is a very large jurisprudence now that has been built up over the years by the courts to say what exactly is meant by substantial and compelling. It's not just something that is reasonable, it's not just something that strikes the official or the court as okay to do. There has to be deeply substantial and compelling. I'm not going to go into the details of what that means, and I'm sure that the drafters are familiar with them, but it sets a high threshold, and that's very important. Enough on the question of application. I want to move to clause 13, the question of the authority to classify state information. It effectively empowers any head of an organ of state to classify information once he or she has applied to the ministry in terms as we've seen in clause 32B. But then it goes on in subclause 2, 3, and 4 of clause 13 to refer to staff at a sufficiently senior level, or to designated staff members, or to decisions being taken at a sufficiently senior level. And one has to ask, what does this mean? What is a sufficiently senior level? Who is to make that judgment? There's no reference here to, for example, the employment grade of the official concerned, or the particular level of responsibility that that official may be may carry, or to their security clearance level, or to their length of service, or anything of the kind. So we don't know, you don't know as members of Parliament, what is meant by a sufficiently senior level, but perhaps more importantly, when the day comes that a minister wishes to delegate the authority to classify, how will the minister know what is meant by sufficiently senior? This kind of confusion is always very bad in law. and it really does need to be cleaned up. If you are going to allow this level of delegation of authority, then you must be absolutely clear about how far it goes, and those who are to exercise the delegation, the head of organs of state, they must know. Otherwise, they can end up delegating far too low down the level of seniority, and then they themselves get into trouble, and they end up unwittingly defeating the whole purpose of this position. So that definitely needs to be very significantly tightened up. Our suggestion is that outside of the security services, the decision to classify information is one that should be made only by a head or acting head of an organ of state, and that the decision should not be delegable at all. That is the safest way to proceed. I want to add in something now which is not in our written submission, but in light of some of the arguments that were made over the last couple of days, I'd like to just comment briefly on Section 14. Clause 14, attempts to ensure that classification is not misused in order to cover up corruption and other crimes which limit scrutiny and so on. It's very wide-ranging. It's very thorough. We don't wish to add anything in particular to Section 14. But what we do want to say is that there's a central difficulty with it, and that is, how will anyone know that the authority to classify has indeed been misused? What if an official decides to risk the punishment spoken of in Section 14? In other words, to ignore Section 14 because the price is too high, because that official stands to gain too much by in fact classifying something which he or she knows ought not to be classified. What if there is some sort of political pressure from whatever quarter on a relatively junior official and they become intimidated? Who will know about that? It's like saying to someone, you are entitled to hide certain things away, A, B, and C, but you may not hide X, Y, Z. How will you know what that person has actually hidden? If that person does actually go and hide X, Y, Z, how will you know? Because it's hidden. It's gone. That's the problem with Section 14. And it gets worse in the sense, if somebody else comes along then, another official, a journalist, member of civil society, a member of parliament, something is brought to your attention by a constituent, okay? And you say, I think I've got some evidence, I think X, Y, Z has been hidden away here, I want to have a look. This bill tells you, no, you can't, it's hidden, it's out of bounds to you. Okay, it says it's classified. You're not allowed to investigate. And that's the problem. Section 14, while it appears to offer protection, in fact, defeat completely any attempt to look underneath and to find out whether classification has been used legitimately or not. It's only going to work, Clause 14 will only work if people other than those who do the classifying are able to ask questions and investigate. And then if they seriously believe that something has been wrongly classified or wrongly hidden, if they are then able to disclose. Alright? That might be some sort of independent review panel that could carry out that task to a certain extent. But it must also be members of society, journalists, investigators, public protector, members of parliament who are approached by constituents, anyone who has serious reason to believe that things have been wrongly classified. Such a person must have the right to dig, and then if they have good reason, to disclose. And that brings us then to the next obvious point, the public interest defense. We add our voice to all the many, many voices that have called for a public interest defense to be included in the bill. I'm not going to go into any great detail about that. I would like to say Clause 19.3 already recognizes the importance of a public defense. That was mentioned by Right to Know this morning, where 19.3b mentions the public interest as one of the criteria for the declassification of wrongly classified material. There are various other areas in our law where public interest stands as a very powerful force for openness. In the law of defamation, for example, you can say something that is defamatory of a person, and if it is in the first place true, and secondly in the public interest, you may well, very well get away with it. In other words, public interest in law can override the importance of a person's good name. Not everyone, and not all the time, but it is one of the criteria. The difficulty with Clause 19 Treaty here is that what it does is it puts into the hands of an official the decision as to whether a disclosure is in the public interest or not. We believe that that decision should be in the hands of the court. The court is far better placed than any government official to make that decision. A court hears arguments from both sides. A court is objective. A court operates in public and according to certain rules of procedure, etc., etc. It's a completely different situation to the arbitrary and sometimes capricious decision of a public servant who says, well, I don't think this is in the public interest, therefore, no disclosure. It is argued sometimes that the idea of a public interest defense is problematic because it kind of undoes the whole secrecy provision. In other words, it says, if somebody discloses information, secret, and then relies on the defense and goes to court, but the court rules against that person, you can't make the information secret again. The cat is out of the bag, the harm has been done. Now that is a valid argument, but it overlooks an important fact, and that is that a person acting in good faith will only disclose information if they are truly satisfied that it is indeed in the public interest to do so. And, this is important, if they are confident that the defense will hold up in court. In other words, they are not going to take the risk of disclosing just in order to get one newspaper headline, and they know very well that it will be found that it wasn't in the public interest, and then they end up going to jail. Okay? People who act in bad faith, people in the raincoats and the hats, the spies, people involved in espionage and so on, they're not interested in the public interest defense. Okay? These are people who take them. If they get hold of secrets, they're going to try to disclose them to their principals, whoever they may be. But the ordinary honest journalist, civil society worker, the public protector, all of these people are only going to disclose if they are satisfied that one, it is in the public interest, and two, that their defense will stand up in court. What does it say further on this point briefly, that there seems to be a fear that has been expressed in some of the questions of honourable members this week, that if a public interest defense is allowed, it is going to be misused. Some people are going to take advantage in order to disclose sensitive information, to sell more newspapers, or to perhaps gain some political or economic advantage. Let's be honest, that might very well happen. It might happen. But the same thing is true of all sorts of other rights and entitlements. People misuse the right of freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of association, and so on. And yet these rights remain safeguarded in our Constitution. And nobody thinks of simply rejecting the whole right to freedom of speech simply because one or two hot-headed people go out there and say things which are in fact an abuse of that right. We punish the people who misuse rights. Okay? We don't withdraw the whole right against the whole population. In a sense, by not having a public interest defense here, that is what this bill is doing. It is withdrawing everybody's right to freedom of information, simply because every now and then one or two people may abuse that right. Chairperson, those are our main substantive points in terms of the bill that we wish to raise. I want to add now just one further point. Before I do that, let's just reiterate what Right to Learn said and many other presenters. This is not an attempt on behalf of the Catholic Church to say this bill is not needed at all. And we certainly do not deny that the state has a legitimate need and duty to protect certain types of information. That you can take as given. I think everybody agrees with that. We are concerned here with the question of excessive seeks and the way in which this law makes excessive inroads into the rights, into the free flow of information. It needs to be tightened up, it needs to be limited, it needs to be tweaked and polished in the way that it was in the National Assembly Committee, but they didn't go quite far enough, and you have the opportunity to take it those few extra steps which it needs to become a very serviceable and useful piece of legislation. And we find that our constitution comes to our rescue, I think, in a very big way here. Yesterday, Kosatu said that if the bill goes through in its present form, they will be the first ones before the Constitutional Court. And the Bali said, our lawyers are standing ready. Legal Resources Centre also said they would be there and they would file an amicus brief. And you know very well, I think, been in the media now since the bill was tabled. All and sundry are willing to take this to court. We would like to suggest that there is one person in the whole country who is best placed to put this before the court, and that is the President. The President can act, and he is the only person who can act in terms of Section 79(4) of the Constitution. It is a prerogative which he has. If he is in any doubt as to the constitutionality of the bill, then before he signs it into law, he can place it before the Constitutional Court for a decision. This has still been used, but it has been used. We believe it's a very, very useful provision for a piece of legislation like this. Because what you have here, again, to be perfectly honest, is a situation where a very small number of people, the drafters of the legislation, the advisors within the intelligence community, and the governing party's members of parliament. They are the people who appear, I should say members of the National Assembly, because you haven't voted on it yet. They are the people who appear to have no reservation about the constitutionality of this bill. Virtually everybody else has reservations. Every legal academic in the country, every constitutional lawyer just about, civil society organizations, etc., etc., have come before you and gone to the media and expressed a wide range of very serious arguments, academic arguments, technical arguments, etc. So clearly there is doubt. I think we must admit there is doubt about the constitutionality. I believe the Chief Legal Advisor and before the National Assembly Committee admitted, yes, there is doubt. The President must harbour the same sort of doubt, surely. And I would urge the committee to recommend to him, no matter what your final deliberations on this bill are and what position you take, put it before the President. This is an excellent opportunity for him to exercise that prerogative in terms of Section 794 and place it before the Constitutional Court before he signs it. It's important that he does it before he signs it. Because if it goes into law, and then people do rush off to the court, and the court overturns it as a whole, or reads out of it certain important sections, either way, you're going to have to deal with it again. You do need a protection of information law. Right? And we see this happening right now as a result of the Constitutional Court's findings on the matter of the Hawkes and the Glenister case. Parliament is having to deal now with the SSPD Services Amendment Bill, go through the whole expense, the whole time-consuming process of trying to correct the piece of legislation, which, at the time that it went through, many people said, is unconstitutional. Clearly, if the President had exercised his prerogatives back then, you wouldn't be looking at that legislation again. So save the time, save the expense, save the embarrassment, save the uncertainty of putting an unconstitutional law on the statute book by referring it in advance to the Constitution. You have the power to ask the President to do that, and I would urge that you make use of it. The Chairperson, those are our submissions. Thank you very much.
Now, thank you very much, Advocate. That was very interesting, straight to the point, presentation, clear proposal. I don't know if there's any further part of that. In actual fact, the guitar is really not so regularly. All Honorable Gund and Honorable Bloom.
Now, Chairperson, let me echo your words. It's true. There, I don't think there's anything that we really need to be careful about. But I would like to just commend the advocate, Mike Potier, for being such straightforward to the point what's really needed. And the best advice that we've just received as an ad hoc committee, before we do certain things, before we embarrass ourselves, we need to do certain issues. Chairperson, I would like to thank you for the advocate. Thank you.
It's not a question. I just want to express my gratitude to the church for this very important advice to us. I will ask the church, don't stop praying for the country. Don't stop, because that is very important. You pray for us during the dark days of apartheid. Don't stop. Please keep on praying.
No, thank you very much, honorable members, and of course to the Catholic bishops. I don't know why I'm so pessimist now all of a sudden. Of ourselves, you know. I think, to me, Honorable Bloom and Honorable Gunda, I would have said thank you very much to the bishop for reminding us, because one thing that we do before even we take our seat as members of parliament, we swear to the Constitution. And you can't swear to something if you don't understand the law. I'm raising this in the context that we must appreciate the reminder, not something that we didn't know. I knew. If you didn't know, you didn't know. But I knew. And it must be like that. And we must appreciate the Catholic Bishop for reminding us that you do have something within the Constitution that you can use in order to resolve the problem that has bedeviled the country, that has polarized the debate in the manner in which it has polarized the debate. But not to look at ourselves now as if we didn't know that there is a constitutional provision that empowers the president to pass any piece of legislation with the constitutional court before he assents to it. I just thought that I must remind you of another group. I was not opening for an engagement. Let me thank the. I'm not Bloom, sorry. No, it's a problem of Kimberly Bloom. That's 150 cases. So we are neighbors, don't worry. No, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Bishop. Of course, I agree with the honorable Bloom. I agree with you. Must continue to pray for us. But for strength, and vision. No, thank you very much, Honorable Bishop and Advocate. We value your contribution. I think it was the best so far for this week. And we are closing our week on a very high note. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Are we going to take a 5 minute tea break?
Yeah.
And then come back. So half past your back, and then we'll take our last topic.
Sorry, that's better. Get it said. Okay. I must start with an apology, and that is.
that the memory stick hadn't saved it, it was saved for the hard drive. So I reconstructed it on the play. So please bear with me. I am not a lawyer, I'm a social scientist. I make the submission in my capacity as a social scientist and a human rights defender. I have no political party affiliations. I work with people of any party who are furthering the cause of the good of South Africa and the Constitution. I'm much too independent-minded to be a member of a political party. I'm not a lawyer, but I mean, that's why I want to say I'm a social scientist, but I want to identify myself with the points made by the last presenter, the advocate. I thought they were very constructive, the concerns, most of the points raised were concerns I had shared. So please understand, my presentation is the work, is informed by the work I do on a day-to-day basis in KwaZulu-Natal, which shares obviously many things with the rest of South Africa, but also has its own unique historical problems. For 20 years I've engaged in a great deal of interventionist work on behalf of victims of violence and other human rights abuses. So I draw my personal experiences for illustrative purposes. As a social anthropologist, my perspective is a comparative one, drawing on material from different societies and providing the broader context, including historical. My basic premise is we are all human beings. We all tend to behave in similar ways in similar circumstances. The differences are because our societies have different histories and different structures, power relationships, institutions. I shall touch on ways in which the provisions of this Act might impact upon my own work in assisting victims of violence. Essentially, my argument is that in some respects this bill breaches international norms relating to access of information and human rights, which are intertwined. The concerns outlined in my written submission refer to the possibility of provisions of this legislation impacting on the public's right to know about violence, which could facilitate its continuation, the bill's overbroad definition of national security, the overconcentration of power to classify in a few hands, an inadequate review mechanism, excessive penalties for breach of legislation, coupled with the lack of a public interest defense. I shall deal with these concerns, which because they're interlinked, under the following headings. Firstly, I'm bringing in an international perspective on classification and over-classification. I'm looking in particular at the South African classification context, the context in which this legislation, if it is passed, will operate, and problems inherent in the legislation itself, and including the excessive penalties, the lack of a public interest defense. And I'll pull these together in my brief conclusion. The international perspective, I think it's a very helpful one because we can learn from international experience. This bill in Section 14 states good intentions, as so much of our legislation in South Africa does. You know, it won't be abused, it won't be used to cover up. But if we look at experience in established democracies such as the UK and the USA, we find that there's a growth over-classification in government bureaucracy, and some of it is to cover up by wrongdoing in government. But I think these are important points because we don't, what I've said at the outset is that human beings are human beings wherever they are. And I don't want you to think that I'm focusing excessively on South Africa. This happens internationally. The UK has had a series of leaks of official documents over the years, including those dealing with the war in Iraq. In one of these cases in 2007, a former Cabinet Office official doc and a former researcher for a Labour MP, O'Connor, were tried and convicted for leaking information to leaking a memo about the 2004 meeting between Prime Minister Blair and President Bush. I'll return briefly to the punishment meted out later. Among other things, this document is alleged to have noted that Bush had proposed to bomb Al Jazeera broadcaster, which, of course, if that had happened, would have been a war crime. According to a journalist from the Guardian newspaper, before the trial, the Foreign Secretary made it clear that it was an embarrassment that the government feared, but she was the one who signed a public interest immunity certificate claiming damage to US-UK relations if it were made public. She claimed it was a risk to harm to national security. In fact, of course, no harm was done. The whole contents of the memo were never made public during the trial. Some were, some weren't. And it's interesting that in such cases, in the trial of these two men, and in other cases, particularly in other cases, the UK, the court and the senior judges have taken the level in opposing secrecy. Thanks to the actions of these judges, various cases have shown that the UK was complicit in illegal activities carried out by the USA in its war against terror. Take, for example, the secret rendition from Pakistan of a British resident, Benjamin Mohammed, by the USA in collusion with Britain's MI5, and his subsequent torture. In this case, the government and lawyers in the UK had relied on what Norton Taylor, a journalist who's written an article about it, described as the tired old argument that secrecy on grounds of national security can't be challenged, which the courts in the UK had previously deferred to, but not any longer. The courts in this trial showed that the UK had tried to prevent the release of classified information about it because it would have shown that the government was complicit in cruel and degrading treatment meted out for Mohammed. Judges did not accept the government's excuse that making this information public would harm relationships between the USA and the UK, including insofar as intelligence gathering was concerned. They said it was impossible to believe that the US would take action against USA if this material was released. Such prospects, they said, public interest, accountability, and the rule of law demanded it, the rule of law being the cornerstone of democracy. In our view, they said, as a court in UK, a vital public interest requires for reasons of accountability and the rule of law in the UK that a summary of the most important evidence relating to the involvement of the British security services in wrongdoing be placed in the public domain in the UK. In this case, the government had wanted to suppress the information about the unlawful activities because they had lied about it being one of the reasons. Top Judge Neuberger commented that some security officials appear to have dubious records when it comes to human rights and coercive techniques. While publicly proclaiming they are for torture, they have privately been complicit in it. There's a campaign for public interest defense which is ongoing in the UK. The American senior counsel, David Covell, also cites examples of overclassification. One well-known example concerns the leak of a secret government report on the Vietnam War by Daniel Ellsberg in 1971. He was deployed to the government then, known as the Pentagon Papers. Ellsberg, like most of the British people, had done it on moral grounds. And in fact, he subsequently said that this was not about national interest, it was not about secret. It shouldn't have been secret because basically it was about American policy in Vietnam. More recently, a subsequent commission on this matter, the Pentagon Papers by Moyan, found that unnecessary classification was rampant in the USA. More recently, the chairperson of a commission established to investigate the attacks of 9/11, September 2001, commented that three-quarters of the documents he had read should never be classified in the first place. The European Court of Human Rights, too, has been highly critical of over-classification, even regarding the situation of armed conflict, because remember, that both the UK and USA and some European powers are actively involved in military operations in the war against terror. In many cases, says the European Human Rights Court, there are violations of basic rights. Right. Now, the South African context in which classification occurs, I pointed out that both of these countries have tightened up on legislation following September 2001, and the tightening up has been vigorously fought by human rights defenders. And of course, they're both involved in fighting wars in the Middle East. The Canadian legislation is also reportedly a response to the threat of terrorism given its borders to the USA. And if you read the legislation, it distinguishes, for example, between espionage and other leakages of information. Now, in South Africa, I find it puzzling, the head of communications from the Ministry of State Security, in a media release dated 2nd of June 2001, said there are no discernible threats to the constitutional order. On the same day, his honourable minister reinforced it, said it's South African stable and secure. Yet a few months later, the honourable minister said he desperately needed this information, foreign spies are installed, tracing us. I shall refer briefly in a minute to the Johannesburg principles, and they make it perfectly clear that citizens of the country are entitled to know what the threats to national security are. South Africa, in contrast to say Europe and the USA, is a newly democratic country, less than 20 years. Democracy doesn't just happen, it needs building, it needs protecting. Classification is supposed to be done by a senior person, and yet our bureaucracies are in a state of flux. There are problems with the bureaucracies. I noticed, I can talk about the police in a minute, I noticed that in the late 90s there was a move in using the sunset clause to put, in our province, to put some of the wrong people in key positions. And they in turn were responsible in appointing other wrong people. There are factions within departments, it's well known. I don't need to remind you about the classification and declassification of the information used by the controversial General Mbluli. I have specific problems with the definition of national security. And the one is the threat of use of force and the use of force. That's very broad. I also have a problem with the, at this point of being made, is the, to include. And I think that a definition of national security needs to spell out very clearly what it's about, unambiguous. That's one problem I have with it, and you'll see how that comes back when I use some examples in a minute. The second is the exposing economic, scientific, or technological secrets. That too is far too broad. I can understand that South Africa would not want to, and I want to stress right throughout this that I do see a need for classification. I'm not against it. I'm saying it must be done judiciously. It must be done with sufficient checks and balances. Now, I can understand that if you are developing a weapon, for example, that there needs to be a degree of secrecy, but then where do you stop? Because we need to learn from the past. We don't want to repeat the mistakes of the past. Basically, science, it's secrecy about science is inimical to science. Science is an open system. It's an open system. It thrives on openness. We have seen the abuse of science by apartheid. Not just science, human sciences, I could speak all day about the abuse of them, but we saw the abuse of science in terms of biological warfare. The worst excesses under apartheid were the sciences. Because they should have known better, they should have been professional, and they weren't. And we have never, ever really dealt with those people. Even the test against both of the sun is faltering. I don't understand why the evidence is there. I must make a note here. Just, I couldn't resist when I was reading this that there seemed to be an obsession with foreign states maybe finding information about the youth corps. I think that's a rather broad, that's a bit too broad. I would like that narrowed down, more specific. I mean, don't let's forget that in this world, a lot of multinationals are more powerful than actual some states. And they can benefit in all sorts of ways. They are benefiting now with the export of human tissue from South Africa, in complicity with researchers on issues like HIV and TB, insufficient control. Tissues from South Africa, blood, for example, is used for patients overseas. So, I mean, we need to look at, when we talk about national interest, international interest, to me, this is a form of new bio-colonialism. Anyway, that's the type of thing that I think this is there. Some points about classification procedure and the criteria. Section 14.3b, I found a bit mind-boggling. Take into consideration the need to protect the individuals. You know, people that the state feels obliged to protect. We have protection people everywhere. I mean, we have bodyguards at all levels of government. And I think, you know, we as taxpayers should find ourselves asking questions about protection for them. Oh, sorry, we can't talk about that. It's classified. Another problem I have is 3F of Section 14. The need to take into account life-threatening harm to the individual. Yes, on the surface that sounds good, but in my experience, openness is one of the best safeguards for people's safety. This is something we use for over 20 years through Amnesty International. If somebody has a threat of harm, publicize it. That gives them a certain protection. We did it back in the 80s and 90s, particularly some of the MECs in the provincial government had letters, trade unionists who were under threat from this squad, had letters publicising it. So, in a sense, you back off a bit if you think you're being exposed. Section 15, yes, you will see in a minute why I have a problem with the police. Returning information to the police, there's a lack of confidence in police. They are feared by many people. They do not enjoy confidence for reasons I'll go into briefly. In terms of implementing and appealing for, I'm jumping a bit because I want to focus on my own problems. For example, yes, we can request the department, section 19, we can request the department access. Now, I hope that departments are suddenly going to start responding within a certain period of time, because I have been engaging with departments for the last 20 years, and I'm getting less and less responses, even acknowledgements at a ministerial level, even acknowledgements from parliamentary portfolio committees in some instances, when I have sent stuff to them. The Fire Act, I will give you a concrete example. A farmer subject to a serious land claim went through working with a senior advocate, applied for information about the claim under the Fire Act, never got a response, never ever. He sent a registered letter to the Department of Land Affairs. It was never collected from the post office. I personally sent a letter once a few years ago to the Speaker of the KZN Legislature. I faxed it, didn't get a response. I sent a registered letter. It was returned to me because it hadn't been collected from the post office. Talking about the practicalities of implementing this, because you probably don't hear this in Parliament. Which brings me to my own, I'm trying to contextualise this. When I read this, I read it with a view of how is this going to impact what I do. And I mean, I follow up various human rights abuses, medical, land related, both for claimants, for example, and for landowners. But especially criminal justice workers, especially policing. Now, the police have a key role to play with this, and yet we have a problem with the police. Maybe more so in KZN. In fact, the ICD tells me that we seem to have more problems in KZN than elsewhere. The recent history of the police is highly politicized, of course. It historically, until very recently, it is highly politicized because of the prevalence, because of being a homeland, the police have been trained to be politicized. They were merged with the SAP, there were divisions. I have a very extensive network, especially of black African policemen. And there were all the divisions remain between those former SAP, former DAP. Now it's become more complex, and I'll tell you how. For example, in the 2004 local government election, the handler of both an IFP warlord in Pietermaritzburg and the ANC Sifiso Lubende, this was in the PRC, was harassing the local ANC candidates. The ANC candidates was also getting harassed by police at the local station, who were linked to the IFP warlord. At the moment, ANC activists in Pietermaritzburg, long-standing people who were harassed by these police, are claiming that they are being harassed by police from another section of the ANC because they, claiming the harassment, are trying to expose corruption. They're trying to get this to the president. They're trying to deal with it that way. Police are exceedingly abusive in KZN. People say to me, if the police want to arrest me, that's fine, but who cares if they'll fool me? And I would ask you, why did it take an article in the Sunday Times to get the paper money unit investigated? I'll give you two examples. This is a caller, a former policeman, middle-aged man, had a door kicked down, he lived in a rural area outside Mandini, had a door kicked down in the middle of the night. He was kicked, abused, suffocated. There's a lot of tubing now. Those of you who are around here in apartheid know all about tubing. They still tube. The pink have a little apparatus they use to tube. McCorder lost consciousness. But because he'd been a policeman, he went off to the station. He reported that he saw the very police at the station. So they were identified. That was 18 months ago. The investigating officer told me that she could not get the head of the unit responsible to organize an ID parade. She still had not been able to do that 2 months ago when I spoke to her. More recent case, Tabitha Zulu. Tabitha Zulu is a young, disciplined ANC leader. Very astute, very good leader. A whole lot of abuses took place in the Crouton, Victorville, Port Shepston, basically Port Shepston cluster area, the PRT, notorious PRT, the Hero on the Province students to everybody. They beat up a whole lot of people for no reason whatsoever. All that I'm saying is recorded in a vast volume of correspondence. I think to be so off, he was abused the second time. He said he was abused because he complained to somebody in CIS. And they got rid of the fact that somebody was complaining about abuse. He was complaining on behalf of other people as well. They beat him up the second time. Please open a case, I said. He did. You know what happened to him? He's in hiding. He had to pay somebody to guard his house. Then he put his wife in the first place. What happened the week or so back? These men come to where his wife works, he's a wife and a small baby. Men come to where his wife works and say, she said, well, the colleague says she's on lunch. Tell them, he said, Ruth and Schlonger wants to see her. Now, this won't mean anything to you unless you come to KZN, but Ruth and Schlonger is a man who's a notorious alleged hitman, including in the Richmond violence, who's always got away with it for some reason. That either it was from Schlonger or it wasn't, we don't know, but it was two installs here. The woman has been in a serious state. Tabitha Zulu is still in hiding. This is what happens when you open a case against the PRT. The police, the RCD has put pressure on the police. The police have been consistently failing to organise an ID parade. So, that's current. The other context in this province is it's a wash with guns. Six truckloads, among the guns delivered in the early 90s, were six truckloads of weapons from Bakbar. Some of those weapons were allegedly uncovered in the early 2000s and some were destroyed, but at the most, two truckloads were destroyed. At most, if that. There were enough weapons in there to start a civil war, according to Dalit Gola Zulu, who was organizing them. Those weapons including RPGs, rocket launchers, etc. This was the detail I haven't got with me. Mahambini, paramilitary training, 2006 to 2008, in rural areas, including in a camp with men wearing hats with the old South African flag on, working with a notorious warlord chief. He broke the law regarding traditional leadership, yet the local, provincial, and national ministers don't respond saying, why haven't you suspended him? He's also got records of the PRC exposing human rights violations. He was involved in that training. And Mrs. Zungu, an ANC activist who'd been threatened by the trainees, threatened by the chief, had a heart attack and destroyed, lost everything. Narrowly escaped with her life. They thought it was a miracle to hit men, but she'd escaped with her life. That's taken in up until recent years. 2008, more paramilitary training at the notorious Mlaba camp up near Ulundi Mashlabatini. I intervened on behalf of three young men who were being held there against their will. Paramilitary training, by the way, I've seen the photos taken by a journalist. The men were in paramilitary uniforms, and that's illegal in terms of PIRA legislation. The police were present. Right. Okay. I contacted the station commissioner, and it was that Saturday. It was only on Sunday the only time those men were free, and they weren't held by the seat.
I thought she was giving us a few examples, but now she's now telling us a lot of other issues, and you have indicated in the beginning that members, you see, members are leaving one by one now. My worry is around time. You indicated that our flights are leaving us tomorrow. And she's now telling us about KwaZulu-Natal not necessarily getting into the bill now, which is the problem.
I finished with my examples. Now, what I'm saying to you, I've given you this example. That's, by the way, that station commissioner is now the provincial commissioner who never replied to letters. This is important for what I want to say, because I get this information. Now, all of this before under classification. How can I follow this up for people? What I do is I pass this to the police. I pass it to anybody who will listen. I'll report from it because I am acting as an advocacy role on behalf of victims. I'm trying to stop this happening. I see nothing happening. I give this information to the police, nothing happens. I am explaining to you that this is going to be even more difficult for me. There's been a lot of focus on the media, right, you know. But those of us working in the field of human rights are going to have even more of a battle finding part. Because I've deliberately said initially, please remember the protectionism in the field. I'm seeing, and it's not just provincial, I'm seeing this right down to the national level because I follow up nationally, that the police, there is no effective burn management. Ordinary policemen tell me this. And these are the people you are giving the power to classify. Right. So I could be in trouble for possessing classified information. That's the bottom line.
Maybe what we can say
we get the point on the level to which police can be frustrated. It has also been echoed by the public protector on her role and her relationship with the police and experience also with the police and for which she made a suggestion on how we need to proceed with that. Okay, let's say that you have the point. Honorable Chief.
Thank you, Chair. I can talk to you before, but I think I've mentioned. Mr. Chair, I want to put a suggestion to you that she may be followed up with ICD and the Ministry of Police. There is a lady there, customer to the name, but I don't mind giving you the number of the lady who's responsible for the area or is a Ministry. Can you negotiate? She is best filled with the area we are working on. And I would still share it is the best for Jamie to really contact and never to contact him. Can assist him so to know the lady. The issue so far is yes, the family needs to wait. Initially, have to do with the overall. But I think it's really important.
Thank you for that. Yes, I did actually report this to the Civilian Secretariat about the paramilitary training. Thank you for that. Yes, and I do work with the ICD. Yeah, I was thinking, I'm using this as an example to say that how easy it is to have to put. You know, how would I know what information was classified and what wasn't? I'm looking now in terms of penalty section 44 and 49. Anyway, I have finished with that. I was going to move on very briefly. The punishment, I won't dwell on that. I think we know what the punishment is, you know, depending on the level of classification, whether it's up to 5 years or the maximum of 25 years. And yet it's only 5 years for disclosure. These are excessively punitive. I want to give you some international examples. I believe that they are disproportionate in terms of, say, I mentioned the Johannesburg principles, and I think as by way of you're wanting sort of suggestions, constructive suggestions, I would suggest that this committee look very seriously at points made by the Johannesburg principles. People drafting them in Johannesburg in the mid-90s, international law experts, including from South Africa, and they deal in some detail with yes, there is a need to classify, but there must be specifics, there must be a burden of proof on the government as to why and how the harm is done in the classification. And it makes the point, I think, it's principle 24. A person, media, outlet, political, or other organization may not be subject to such sanctions, restraints, or penalty for a security-related crime involving freedom of expression or information that are disproportionate to the seriousness of his action. I believe that these penalties are disproportionate to the action. And I just want to briefly look at Canadian legislation. If you look at that, there's a lot of nuances depending on what it is. Obviously, espionage, you see, we need to distinguish between espionage and just possessing classified information, which may be about human rights issues, like the ones I've mentioned, or it may be about general corruption. I mean, this issue of it may benefit a foreign government. You know, we're dealing with multinationals, we're dealing with groupings of armed governments that may benefit. Now, how do you stop people getting to know in this age of the internet what they may benefit from? I mean, in Canada, it's a maximum of 5 years for a person bound by secrecy to pass on information, even that may be special operations information. There's a maximum of 14 years if it is special operations information, but all of this is subject to a public interest override. That's the important thing, and that is what South Africa has to learn from. from the Canadian legislation. The UK doesn't have public interest. There's a big campaign there for it, but the maximum in terms of the Official Secrecies Act is what, 14 years? And it was recently amended for a fine or 2 years imprisonment. I've given the case of Sarah Sizzle, who leaked military information. She was in prison for 6 months. Carson O'Connor, that I referred to earlier, who leaked the memo about the about the Blair Bush meeting, got 6 months and 3 months respectively. And that is, I mean, for leaking stuff that, you know, and the judges didn't buy in that it would harm international relations. I could not help noticing that these penalties are close to fact against the Malaysian legislation, which is highly punitive. And I believe unfairly so, particularly in the absence of a public interest override defense. Yes, I know it's built into some of the clauses. Let me conclude now, I've gone on already, I don't too long. With my conclusion, trying to draw this together, there is too much power in two for your hands. Remember, I am speaking as a comparative social scientist. I'm looking generally. We have to, you know, I mean, even if you take a pre-colonial society with a traditional chief, there were always diffuse centers of power. People, if they were men anyway, but women didn't have the vote in democracies until the 1930s or so. At least there were checks and balances on the power of that traditional leader. It wasn't all inherent in just the traditional leadership system. It was colonialism that turned that on its head. So it's a matter of principle, regardless. I mean, I have referred to the specific situation prevailing at the moment for my students in KZN, but this is a generic problem in any society. You can't concentrate too much power into your hands. The wording needs to be tightened up. And as I said, I want to identify with what the last speaker said. I think we definitely need rewording of definitions. The practical problems, I've spent a lot of time talking about the practical problems. And, you know, part of it is systemic, and we need to find ways of, if this legislation is tidied up and implemented, it needs to be workable. We need to bear in mind that it must be workable. Too much of our legislation is excellent legislation, and it doesn't get implemented. There are inadequate controls, as I said, it's linked with... look, I know there is an independent review panel, but I don't think... and I know that it is appointed and responsible to Parliament, but remember that in Parliament there is one party that is going to carry the majority. You can nominate... Reminded me of a bit like the university selection committee. You go through the process of transparency, but everybody knows who they want. They want, and that's what happens in the long run. And I believe that judicial review maybe needs to be explored to make it some, you know, to increase the independence. I really believe there should be a public interest defense. I think this point is being made over and over again. I think, I went into this thing about violence because in the 1980s and 90s, and in the 80s particularly, I saw what was happening. But the media, look, the media had its own problems, but some of the media were quite courageous and wanting to report it. The Witness, for example, in Maritzburg. What happened was, they immediately got threatened with court action because of emergency regulations. Emergency regulations have the effect of doing what this legislation may do in covering up from ordinary people the threat of violence in their midst. And what happened in the 80s was that a large sect of society didn't know what was going on. They actually did not know how the state was sponsoring the violence. Yes, they didn't want to know. A lot of them didn't want to know. But that's what I meant when I said that openness is very important when it comes to violence. You know, I said to Kabisa Zulu, I said, look, I'm going to mention your case, name publicly gives them a degree of protection. It must not be stifled by interpretation. So I think we should, to end on a positive note, I'm sure the intention wasn't. I mean, Malaysia is a country that South Africa would not want to emulate. It has press restrictions, it has detention without trial, it has people are caned, including women, it still has death penalty. These are all the antithesis of what our committee, our constitution stands for. We would not want to associate with that. But the severity of the legislation in places is very similar. I think we can learn a lot comparatively from the way other countries are handling this. I don't know if the state legal advisors did enough comparative homework. I think that's their job. Thank you very much for inviting me and listening to me.
No, thank you very much, Manager. No, I'm very happy that I don't see the hands of the Honourable Rule going up. And I see Honourable Prince Rule also had left because he had to be excused. Because there are some cases there, and I thought that they would have to defend certain things and correct certain things. I'm not saying that they were. No, thanks a lot. Well, I think it was quite helpful from a sociological point of view and how it impacts also on ordinary people's lives. And we need to be alive to some of these challenges as a committee. And I think it has really affected us a lot. And let me thank you once more. I think it's that members are here. Or do you want to engage another chance?
No, I can't say this. There's no question. I appreciate that. The point I had, she clarified that she was presenting all those comparative cases. But the point that I think is important to me is the point that was made that she, not even in the fact that you have reported the matter that you're talking about to Eva, but I think you should take her up on that suggestion that you are making to meet you up with somebody else. Because I think as a member of parliament, you can also be in the position of following up if you did get some kind of assistance. Particularly on those cases that you are mentioning are happening to people who are trying to do things right for the community and also those intimidations and the rights of other people. I think it is very much important. And I hope by saying I have already raised this with the ICD, you are not actually rejecting the offer. Because that will not be helpful on the matter. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Honorable Bloom.
It's a short one. Thank you very much. And thank you very much for the presentation. It's just a clarification. Before you, the Catholic Bishop Conference were presenting, they were saying, I'm tackling your last statement to say that this bill will do what an emergency legislation or at times emergency. Now the Catholic Bishop's Council has said there is no one about which bill. Now there's a conversation. I just want clarity on that aspect, on the last comment.
Maybe just before you respond to that, I think the public protector, in terms of, just to take you on the comparative studies, international comparative studies, the public protector made reference to a Swedish system. I don't know if you had made such comparative study with the Swedish system. Okay, not as part of that, I wanted your opinion on.
Look, my time was limited. I know I'm strictly speaking a pensioner because I retired from academia a few years back, but I'm really busy. I follow up a lot of, I've been writing, but I also follow up cases for people. people all the time. David Monroe's cases, most of them criminal justice, but a number of them land medical rights. But I just want to come back to what the Honourable Member brought up about the comparison between apartheid and now. I think the point I was making is that my belief is that there must be maximum openness, there must be minimum. Every society, every country needs to protect certain information. You know, that's non-negotiable. It will, you know, there will be some sort of act to cover military, for example, and intelligence, diplomatic things. I'm not denying that, but I believe that it should be minimalist rather than this open, potentially, given international experience, the floodgate for maximum classification, given the wide range in the legislation. Now, I believe that freedom of information is really crucial in terms, I make the point over and over again about it protecting people, as everybody knows, look, you are subject to threats from a hitman, if we publicize that, maybe he'll back off or something. Now, what I meant by apartheid was that under apartheid, look, part of the problem was the structure of apartheid, the way that Bob and subsequent intelligence people had used the media, that's all history. But it was also, there were also decent people. I mean, I read an article in 86 saying, you know, with a white skin, it's like I'm a stranger in my own society, because if I say things because I'm in the township, people just don't know what I'm talking about. You see, reality is socially constructed. And you learn about things by what you either learn in interaction or what you read. And you all obviously read conflicting reports. Now, what the apartheid regime did was that it actually introduced a state of emergency, and journalists were penalized if they reported outside of those conditions. Some managed to get around it, others were intimidated. Now, what I'm saying is, yes, the situation is very different, but classification of information can have exactly the same impact. So I'm talking about different mechanisms for doing the same thing. I hope that clears up.
No, thank you very much, Meredy. Has got one of our morale, of course, meaning that the one that beats the last is the king. So you were the last one, meaning therefore you summed up our week in terms of our presentation. let me thank you for that. Let me thank you for Gordis, who has been with us throughout the week as well. And let me thank, most importantly, members of parliament, whom ordinarily, as we speak, should have been in their constituencies, interacting with their constituencies, doing their constituency work, because it would be expected of them to report to their political parties on what they have done to assist their constituencies. And these are members who have decided and agreed to commit themselves to this process. And I think something that we really need to appreciate for them to have taken off time from their constituency period to be in parliament, ensuring that we deepen the democratic processes and broaden our participatory capacity as parliament to ensure that not only do we become people who are the ones who must determine what then becomes the ultimate product or the outcome that is or presents itself as a challenge to the country and so on. And these are men and women, mothers and fathers, who had decided to leave their families during this time to ensure that the country faced with this challenge. They are going to be here. They are going to ensure that they commit themselves to this process. And I think it's only fair to really thank members of the committee for their commitment and dedication. And of course, the political parties to have had an understanding to release them in order to be here with us today. Officials from the department, the media, everybody who has been with us throughout the week, all the presenters who have been with us also, we have taken all time from their busy schedules. I mean, we are not only talking about any other person here. We are talking of people who are advocates, we are talking about senior people, we are talking very busy people, but they managed to take up time from their schedules to come and make a contribution in ensuring that we build a better country, a country that is informed, that is open to the views of everybody, and ensuring that this kind of dialogue that we have created as a committee is not a dialogue that is just left to chance, but it's a dialogue that would make a meaningful and valuable a growth and development, of course, of whatever that we are expected to do by the Constitution of the Republic. It is for that I want to thank everybody who has been with us. Once more, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair. You are a born again from today.